University in St. Louis, where Compton had once hidden out, and arranged to have 300-pound batches of uranium nitrate hexahydrate bombarded heroically with neutrons for weeks and months at a time. So long and intense a bombardment would give him microgram quantities of plutonium, several hundred millionths of a gram, amounts hardly visible to the naked eye. He then somehow had to devise techniques for mixing, measuring, and analyzing them. Visiting New York earlier that month to deliver a lecture, Seaborg had sought out a quaint soul named Anton Alexander Benedetti Pickler, a professor at Queens College in Flushing, who had pioneered ultra-microchemistry, a technology for manipulating extremely small quantities of chemicals. Benedetti Pickler had briefed Seaborg thoroughly and promised to send a list of essential equipment. Seaborg hired one of Benedetti Pickler's former students, and together the two men planned an ultra-microchemistry laboratory. We looked for a good spot that would be vibration-free for the microbalances and settled on room 405, a former darkroom, in Jones' laboratory, which has a concrete bench. The former darkroom, hardly 6 feet by 9, was scaled to the work. Another specialist in ultra-microchemistry, Paul Kirk, taught at Berkeley. Seaborg hired a recent PhD whom Kirk had trained, Burris Cunningham, and a graduate student, Louis B. Werner. "I always thought I was tall," the chemistry laureate comments, but Werner, at 6'7", topped him by 4 inches. A tight fit in the small laboratory. With the special tools of ultra-microchemistry, the young chemists could work on undiluted quantities of chemicals as slight as tenths of a microgram. A dime weighs about 2.5 grams, 2,500,000 micrograms. They would manage their manipulations on the mechanical stage of a binocular stereoscopic microscope adjusted to 30 power magnification. Fine glass capillary straws substituted for test tubes and beakers. Pipettes filled automatically by capillary attraction. Small hypodermic syringes mounted on micromanipulators injected and removed reagents from centrifuge microcones. Miniature centrifuges separated precipitated solids from liquids. The first balance the chemists used consisted of a single quartz fiber fixed at one end like a fishing pole stuck into a riverbank inside a glass housing that protected it from the least breath of air. To weigh their Lilliputian quantities of material, they hung a weighing pan made of a snippet of platinum foil that was itself almost too small to see to the free end of the quartz fiber and measured how much the fiber bent, a deflection which was calibrated against standard weights. A more rugged balance developed at Berkeley had double pans suspended from opposite ends of a quartz fiber beam strung with microscopic struts. It was said, notes Seaborg, that invisible material was being weighed with an invisible balance. In addition to his new MetLab responsibilities, Seaborg still coordinated basic scientific studies of uranium and plutonium at Berkeley. At the beginning of June, he traveled to California to meet with the fellows on the third floor of Gilman Hall and to marry Ernest Lawrence's secretary. On June 6th, returning to Chicago through Los Angeles, where Seaborg's parents lived, bride and groom prepared for a quick Nevada wedding. They got off the train in Caliente, Nevada, stored their bags with the telegraph operator at the station, and asked directions to the city hall. But to our vexation, we learned that there is no city hall here, and in order to get our marriage license, we would have to go to the county seat, a town called Pioche, some 25 miles to the north. Providentially, the deputy sheriff, who served as Caliente's travel advisor and all-around troubleshooter, turned out to be a June graduate of the Berkeley Chemistry Department. He arranged for the professor and his bride, Helen Griggs, to ride to Pioche in a mail truck. Our witnesses were a janitor, whom we recruited, and a friendly clerk. We returned to Caliente on the mail truck's 4:30 run and checked into the local hotel here for our overnight stay. Arriving in Chicago on June 9th, Seaborg delivered his wife to the apartment he had rented before he left for California and proceeded immediately to his office. His mail informed him that Edward Teller was joining the Chicago project to work in the theoretical group under Eugene Wigner. 2 days later, Robert Oppenheimer turned up in Chicago and dropped by to see Seaborg. They were old friends, but it was more than just a social call. Gregory Bright, the Wisconsin-based theoretician on the Uranium Committee, who had been responsible for fast neutron studies, had resigned from the bomb project in protest over what he felt were serious violations of security. "I do not believe that secrecy conditions are satisfactory in Dr. Compton's project," he had written Briggs on May 18th. His litany of examples approached paranoia. "Within the Chicago Project, there are several individuals strongly opposed to secrecy. One of the men, for example, coaxed my secretary there to give him some official reports out of my safe while I was away on a trip. The same individual talks quite freely within the group. I have heard him advocate the principle that all parts of the work are so closely interrelated that it is desirable to discuss them as a whole." The dangerous individual Bright chose not to name was Enrico Fermi, pushing to make the chain reaction go. Compton had appointed Oppenheimer to replace Bright, and Oppenheimer was visiting Seaborg for a briefing on the fast neutron studies Seaborg was coordinating at Berkeley. "Studying fast neutron reactions," Seaborg notes, "was a prerequisite to the design of an atomic bomb." Oppenheimer had found a place for himself on the ground floor. The Washington University cyclotron crew moved the first 300 pounds of uranium nitrate hexahydrate into position around the machine's beryllium target on June 17th. The UNH was scheduled for a month's bombardment, 50,000 microampere hours. Though the chain reaction had not yet been proved, and no one had yet seen plutonium, the various MetLab councils of which Seaborg was a member had already begun debating the design and location of the big 250,000 kilowatt production piles that would create pounds of the strange metal, if all went well. Fermi thought plutonium production needed an area a mile wide and 2 miles long for safety. Compton proposed building piles of increasing power to work up to full-scale production, and was considering alternative sites in the Lake Michigan Dunes area and in the Tennessee Valley. A question that would eventually encompass many other issues, some of them profound, was how to cool the big piles. Early in the organization of the Met Lab, Compton had appointed an engineering council to consider such questions. Besides an engineer and an industrial chemist, the council included Samuel Allison, Fermi, Seaborg, Szilard, and John A. Wheeler among its membership. By late June, its discussions had progressed to the point of tentative commitment. Helium was one prospective coolant, to be circulated at high pressure inside a sealed steel shell. Its zero cross-section for neutron absorption was only one of its several advantages. Water was another coolant possibility, the heat exchange medium most familiar to engineers, but corrosive to uranium. An exotic third was bismuth, a metal with a low 520 degree Fahrenheit melting point that serves as a watchful solid in fuses and automatic fire alarms. Melted to a liquid, it would transfer heat far more efficiently than helium or water. Szilard championed a liquid bismuth cooling system, in part because the metal could be circulated through the pile with a scaled-up version of the magnetic pump he and Albert Einstein had invented for refrigerators, a mechanism that had no moving parts to leak or fail. The engineering council ruled out liquid cooling, Seaborg writes, because of potential chemical action, danger of leaks, and difficulty in transferring heat from oxide. There was general agreement to use helium. Eugene Wigner had not been invited onto the council despite his interest in its problems and his thorough knowledge of chemical engineering. Wigner strongly favored water cooling, says Szilard, because a water-cooled system could be built in a much shorter time. Seaborg corroborates Wigner's continuing desperate concern about a German bomb. Compton repeated a conversation that ensued between him and Wigner on a possible schedule of the Germans. "Like us, they've had 3 years since the discovery of fission to prepare a bomb. Assuming they know about plutonium, they could run a heavy water pile for 2 months at 100,000 kilowatts and produce 6 kilograms of it. Thus, it would be possible for them to have 6 bombs by the end of this year, 1942. On the other hand, we don't plan to have bombs in production until the first part of 1944. Compton encouraged Wigner's group to design a water-cooled pile, but ordered up detailed engineering studies only of a system using helium. The basic issue behind the technical dispute was control, which Szilard at least understood they were systematically signing away to the U.S. government. A meeting on June 27th intensified the conflict. Bush's latest status report to Roosevelt on June 17th had proposed dividing the work of development and ultimate production between the OSRD and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, bringing in the Army to build and run the factories, as Bush had planned to do all along. Roosevelt initialed Bush's cover letter, OK FDR, and returned it immediately. The same day, the Chief of Engineers ordered Colonel James C. Marshall of the Syracuse Engineer District, a 1918 West Point graduate with experience building air bases, to report to Washington for duty. Marshall selected the Boston Construction Engineering Corporation of Stone and Webster as principal contractor for the bomb project. To report the reorganization, Compton called the June 27th meeting of his group leaders and planning board. Allison, Fermi, Seaborg, Szilard, Teller, Wigner, and Zinn attended, among others. Compton opened the meeting with a pep talk, Seaborg remembers, asking us to go ahead with all vigor possible. He said our aim the past half year has been to investigate the possibilities of producing an atom bomb. Now, we have the responsibility to proceed from the military point of view on the assumption it can be done, and we can assume we have a project for the entire duration of the war. Compton was stealthily working his way to the new arrangements. He emphasized the program's secrecy. Only about 6 men in the U.S. Army are permitted to know what is going on, Seaborg paraphrases him. Those privileged few included Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, heady company for men who had only recently been graduate students or obscure academics, and 2 construction experts, generals whom Compton then named. He described the responsibilities of the construction experts and finally broke the news. It is hoped to have a contractor assume responsibility for the production plant. A contractor already had. Compton's announcement had the same effect he seems to have feared, Seaborg goes on. A number of the people present expressed great concern about working for an industrial contractor because of their fear that this would not be a compatible environment in which to work. They would not have to work for such a contractor, though they would obviously have to work with one. But to make the reorganization palatable, Compton hinted at worse that might be yet to come. There was considerable talk about our being absorbed into the Army, that is, commissioned as officers, and what the advantages and disadvantages might be. There were vigorous objections from most of the people present. The problem would fester all summer and burst through again in the fall. Szilard would define it precisely in a memorandum. Stated in abstract form, the trouble at Chicago arises out of the fact that the work is organized along somewhat authoritative rather than democratic lines. The visionary Hungarian physicist did not believe science could function by fiat. In 1939, he had already written Vannevar Bush passionately in late May, before the cooling system and contractor debates, the government of the United States was given a unique opportunity by Providence. This opportunity was lost. Nobody can tell now whether we shall be ready before German bombs wipe out American cities. Such scanty information as we have about work in Germany is not reassuring, and all one can say with certainty is that we could move at least twice as fast if our difficulties were eliminated. 300 pounds of irradiated UNH, yellowish crystals like rock salt, arrived from St. Louis by truck on July 27th, a Monday. The UNH was surrounded by a layer of lead bricks. Truman Komen and Elwin H. Covey were detailed to unload the shipment and carry it up to our lab on the fourth floor for extraction of the 94-239. The UNH crystals came packaged in small boxes of various sizes, made to fit into the various niches around the cyclotron target. Some of the boxes were made of masonite, but most of them were of quarter-inch plywood. Unfortunately, some of the seams and edges had cracked open, allowing crystals of hot, that is radioactive, UNH to creep out. We could not get hold of any instrument to measure the radioactivity. I told Komen and Covey their best protection would be to wear rubber gloves and a lab coat. Although they struggled for half the day to get all the boxes and lead bricks upstairs into the storage area, I think they were conscientious and kept their radiation exposure to a minimum. While Seaborg's high-spirited crew of young chemists began attempting to extract plutonium-239 from the bulky St. Louis UNH, wrestling with carboys of ether and heavy 3-liter separatory funnels held at arm's length from behind lead shields, Cunningham and Werner, in narrow room 405, started toward isolating plutonium as a pure compound. They first measured out a 15-milliliter solution of UNH irradiated earlier that summer in the 60-inch Berkeley cyclotron. They assumed their solution then contained about 1 microgram of plutonium-239. PU-239, that is. Seaborg had chosen the abbreviation PU rather than PL, partly to avoid confusion with platinum, PT, but also, facetiously, he says, to create attention. PU, the old slang for putrid, something that raises a stink. Working with their ultra-microchemical equipment, slow, tedious operations via micro-manipulator, gearing down large motions to microscopically small, on August 15th, a Saturday, they mixed the rare earths cerium and lanthanum into their solution as carriers, partially evaporated it, and precipitated the carriers and the PU as fluorides. They dissolved the precipitated crystals in a few drops of sulfuric acid and evaporated the resulting solution to a volume of about 1 milliliter, a thousandth of a liter, some 20 drops. They checked the larger volume of solution left behind and found essentially no alpha activity, evidence that the alpha-active PU had crystallized out with the rare earths. That was a day's work, and they stored the precipitate solution carefully for Monday and went home. On Monday, August 17th, Cunningham and Werner began by oxidizing their small volume of precipitate to change the oxidation state of its PU. They repeated the oxidation and reduction cycles on the solution several times. At the end of the day, their quartz centrifuge microcone contained a minute drop of liquid that radiated some 57,000 alpha particles per minute. They set it in a steam bath to concentrate it. On Tuesday, the two men transferred the concentrated solution to a shallow platinum dish to prepare to concentrate it further. It began creeping over the sides. Rather than lose it, they moved it quickly to the only larger dish at hand, which was contaminated with lanthanum. Their misjudgment of volume condemned them to another day of repurifying. Upstairs in the attic and on the roof, Seaborg's bulk UNH crew stirred large volume extractions of ether and water. It was hot and heavy work. Room 405 had a purified concentrate again to process Wednesday morning. It was still contaminated with a potassium compound and with silver. Cunningham and Werner diluted it and precipitated out the silver as a chloride. They added 5 micrograms of lanthanum and precipitated out the PU along with the lanthanum carrier. They dissolved the precipitate, oxidized it once more to change over the PU and precipitated out the lanthanum. That left pure plutonium in solution. One morning's work to bring down. Of Thursday, August 20th, 1942, Seaborg writes, "Perhaps today was the most exciting and thrilling day I have experienced since coming to the Met Lab. Our microchemists isolated pure element 94 for the first time. This morning, Cunningham and Werner set about fuming yesterday's 94 solution containing about 1 microgram of 94-239, added hydrofluoric acid, whereupon the reduced 94 precipitated as the fluoride, free of carrier material. This precipitate of 94, which was viewed under the microscope, and which was also visible to the naked eye, did not differ visibly from the rare earth fluorides. It is the first time that element 94 has been beheld by the eye of man. By afternoon, a holiday spirit prevailed in our group. After several hours' exposure to air, the precipitated plutonium had taken on a pinkish hue. Someone photographed Cunningham and Werner at their crowded bench in the narrow, tile-walled room, trim, strong-jawed young men looking weary. The crew upstairs that muscled carboys and lead bricks shuffled in like clumsy shepherds to peer through the microscope at the miracle of the tiny, pinkish speck. In the summer of 1942, Robert Oppenheimer gathered together at Berkeley a small group of theoretical physicists he was amused to call the luminaries. Their job was to throw light on the actual design of an atomic bomb. Hans Bethe, now 36 and a highly respected professor of physics at Cornell, had resisted joining the bomb project because he doubted the weapon's feasibility. "I considered an atomic bomb so remote," Bethe told a biographer after the war, "that I completely refused to have anything to do with it. Separating isotopes of such a heavy element as uranium was clearly a very difficult thing to do, and I thought we would never succeed in any practical way." But Bethe may well have headed the list of luminaries Oppenheimer wanted to attract. By 1942, the Cornell physicist had established himself as a theoretician of the first rank. His most outstanding contribution, for which he would receive the 1967 Nobel Prize in Physics, was to elucidate the production of energy in stars, identifying a cycle of thermonuclear reactions involving hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen that is catalyzed by carbon and culminates in the creation of helium. Among other important work during the 1930s, Bethe had been principal author of three lengthy review articles on nuclear physics, the first comprehensive survey of the field. Bound together, the three authoritative studies came to be called Bethe's Bible. He had wanted to help oppose Nazism. "After the fall of France," he says, "I was desperate to do something, to make some contribution to the war effort. First, he developed a basic theory of armor penetration. On the recommendation of Theodor von Karman, whom he consulted at Caltech, he and Edward Teller in 1940 extended and clarified shockwave theory. In 1942, he joined the radiation laboratory at MIT to work on radar. That was where Oppenheimer found him." Oppenheimer cleared his plan with Lee A. Dubridge, the director of the Rad Lab, then set a senior American theoretician, John H. Van Vleck, professor of physics at Harvard, to snare Bethe for the Berkeley summer study. "The essential point," he counseled Van Vleck, "is to enlist Bethe's interest, to impress on him the magnitude of the job we have to do, and to try to convince him, too, that our present plans are the appropriate machinery." Oppenheimer felt the weight of the work. "Every time I think about our problem, a new headache appears," he told the Harvard professor. "We shall certainly have our hands full." Van Vleck arranged to meet Bethe conspiratorially in Harvard Yard and succeeded in convincing him he was needed. The prearranged signal to Oppenheimer was a Western Union kiddygram, an inexpensive standardized telegram with a message like, "Brush your teeth." Oppenheimer also invited Edward Teller. In 1939, Bethe had married Rose Ewald, the attractive and intelligent daughter of his Stuttgart physics professor, Paul Ewald. Edward and Michi Teller, our best friends in this country, had attended the New Rochelle wedding. Setting out for Berkeley in early July 1942, the Bethes stopped over in Chicago to pick up the Tellers. Teller showed Bethe Fermi's latest exponential pile. "He had a setup under one of the stands in Stagg Field," Bethe remembers, "in a squash court with tremendous stacks of graphite. A chain reaction that made plutonium would bypass the problem of isotope separation. I then," says Bethe, "became convinced that the atomic bomb project was real and that it would probably work." The other luminaries enlisted for the summer study were Van Vleck, the Swiss-born Stanford theoretician Felix Bloch, Oppenheimer's former student and close collaborator Robert Serber, a young Indiana theoretician named Emil Konopinski, and two postdoctoral assistants. Konopinski and Teller had arrived at the Met Lab at about the same time earlier that year. "We were newcomers in the bustling laboratory," Teller writes in a memoir, "and for a few days we were given no specific jobs." Teller proposed that he and Konopinski review his calculations that seemed to prove the impossibility of using an atomic bomb to ignite a thermonuclear reaction in deuterium. Konopinski agreed, and we tackled the job of writing a report to show, once and for all, that it could not be done. But the more we worked on our report, the more obvious it became that the roadblocks which I had erected for Fermi's idea were not so high after all. We hurdled them one by one, and concluded that heavy hydrogen actually could be ignited by an atomic bomb to produce an explosion of tremendous magnitude. By the time we were on our way to California, we even thought we knew precisely how to do it. That was not news Edward Teller was likely to hide under a bushel, whatever Oppenheimer's official agenda. Beta was ushered into the glare as the streamliner clicked west. We had a compartment on the train to California so we could talk freely. Teller told me that the fission bomb was all well and good, and essentially was now a sure thing. In reality, the work had hardly begun. Teller likes to jump to conclusions. He said that what we really should think about was the possibility of igniting deuterium by a fission weapon, the hydrogen bomb. At Berkeley, the luminaries began meeting in Oppenheimer's office, in the northwest corner of the fourth floor of Old LeConte Hall, an older colleague remembers. Like all those rooms, it had French doors opening out onto a balcony, to which there was easy access from the roof. Accordingly, a very strong wire netting was fastened securely over his balcony. Only Oppenheimer had a key. If a fire had ever started in Oppenheimer's absence, it would have been tragic. But the fires that summer were still only theoretical. The theoreticians let Teller's bomb distract them. It was new, important, and spectacular, and they were men with a compulsion to know. The theory of the fission bomb was well taken care of by Serber and two of his young people, Beta explains. They seemed to have it well under control, so we felt we didn't need to do much. The essentials of fast neutron fission were firm. It needed experiment more than theory. The senior men turned their collective brilliance to fusion. They had not yet bothered to name generic bombs of uranium and plutonium. But from the pre-anthropic darkness, where ideas abide in non-existence until minds imagine them into the light, the new bomb emerged already chased with the technocratic euphemism of Art Deco slang. The Super, they named it. Rose Betha, who was then 24, understood instantly. "My wife knew vaguely what we were talking about," says Betha. "And on a walk in the mountains in Yosemite National Park, she asked me to consider carefully whether I really wanted to continue to work on this. Finally, I decided to do it. The Super was a terrible thing. But the fission bomb had to come first in any case, and the Germans were presumably doing it." Teller had examined two thermonuclear reactions that fuse deuterium nuclei to heavier forms and simultaneously release binding energy. Both required that the deuterium nuclei be hot enough when they collided, energetic enough, violently enough in motion, to overcome the nuclear electrical barrier that usually repels them. The minimum necessary energy was thought at the time to come to about 35,000 electron volts, which corresponds to a temperature of about 400 million degrees. Given that temperature, and on Earth, only an atomic bomb might give it, both thermonuclear reactions should occur with equal probability. In the first, two deuterium nuclei collide and fuse to helium-3 with the ejection of a neutron and the release of 3.2 million electron volts of energy. In the second, the same sort of collision produces tritium, hydrogen-3, an isotope of hydrogen, with a nucleus of one proton and two neutrons that does not occur naturally on Earth. with the ejection of a proton and the release of 4 MeV of energy. The D plus D reaction's release of 3.6 MeV was slightly less by mass than fission's net of 170 MeV. But fusion was essentially a thermal reaction, not inherently different in its kindling from an ordinary fire. It required no critical mass and was therefore potentially unlimited. Once ignited, its extent depended primarily on the volume of fuel, deuterium, its designers supplied. And deuterium, Harold Urey's discovery, the essential component of heavy water, was much easier and less expensive to separate from hydrogen than U-235 was from U-238, and much simpler to acquire than plutonium. Each kilogram of heavy hydrogen equaled about 85,000 tons of TNT equivalent. Theoretically, 12 kilograms of liquid heavy hydrogen, 26 pounds, ignited by one atomic bomb, would explode with a force equivalent to 1 million tons of TNT. So far as Oppenheimer and his group knew at the beginning of the summer, an equivalent fission explosion would require some 500 atomic bombs. That reckoning alone would have been enough to justify devoting the summer to imagining the super a little way out of the darkness. Teller found something else as well, or thought he did, and with his usual pell-mell facility, he scattered it before them. There are many other thermonuclear reactions besides the D plus D reactions. Bethe had examined a number of them methodically when looking for those that energized massive stars. Now Teller offered several which a fission bomb or a super might inadvertently trigger. He proposed to the assembled luminaries the possibility that their bombs might ignite the Earth's oceans or its atmosphere and burn up the world, the very result Hitler occasionally joked about with Albert Speer. "I didn't believe it from the first minute," Bethe scoffs. "Oppie took it sufficiently seriously that he went to see Compton. I don't think I would have done it if I had been Oppie, but then Oppie was a more enthusiastic character than I was. I would have waited until we knew more." Oppenheimer had other urgent business with Compton, in any case, the super itself. Not to risk their loss, the bomb project leaders were no longer allowed to fly. Oppenheimer tracked Compton by telephone at the beginning of a July weekend to a country store in northern Michigan where he had stopped to pick up the keys to his lakeside summer cottage, got directions, and caught the next train east. In the meantime, Bethe applied himself to Teller's calculations. The Cornell physicist's instant skepticism gives perspective to Compton's melodramatic recollection of his meeting with Oppenheimer. "I'll never forget that morning. I drove Oppenheimer from the railroad station down to the beach, looking out over the peaceful lake. There, I listened to his story. Was there really any chance that an atomic bomb would trigger the explosion of the nitrogen in the atmosphere or the hydrogen in the ocean? This would be the ultimate catastrophe. Better to accept the slavery of the Nazis than to run a chance of drawing the final curtain on mankind." We agreed there could be only one answer. Oppenheimer's team must go ahead with their calculations. Bethe already had. I very soon found some unjustified assumptions in Teller's calculations, which made such a result extremely unlikely, to say the least. Teller was very soon persuaded by my arguments. The arguments, Bethe's and others, against a runaway explosion appear most authoritatively in a technical history of the bomb design program prepared under Oppenheimer's supervision immediately after the war. It was assumed that only the most energetic of several possible thermonuclear reactions would occur, and that the reaction cross-sections were at the maximum values theoretically possible. Calculation led to the result that no matter how high the temperature, energy loss would exceed energy production by a reasonable factor. At an assumed temperature of 3 million electron volts, compare the 35,000 EV known for D plus D, the reaction failed to be self-propagating by a factor of 60. This temperature exceeded the calculated initial temperature of the deuterium reaction by a factor of 100, and that of the fission bomb by a larger factor. The impossibility of igniting the atmosphere was thus assured by science and common sense. Oppenheimer returned to that good news, and they proceeded with the super. Teller recaptures the mood. My theories were strongly criticized by others in the group, but together with new difficulties, new solutions emerged. The discussions became fascinating and intense. Facts were questioned, and the questions were answered by still more facts. A spirit of spontaneity, adventure, and surprise prevailed during those weeks in Berkeley. And each member of the group helped move the discussion toward a positive conclusion. There was serious trouble with Teller's D plus D super. The reactions would proceed too slowly to reach ignition before the fission trigger blew the assembly apart. Konopinski came to the rescue. Konopinski suggested that, in addition to deuterium, we should investigate the reactions of the heaviest form of hydrogen, tritium. This, Teller explains, was at that time only a conversational guess. One tritium reaction of obvious interest was the fusion of a deuterium nucleus with a tritium nucleus, D plus T, which results in the formation of a helium nucleus with the ejection of a neutron and the release of 17.6 MeV of energy. The D plus T reaction kindled at a mere 5,000 EV, which corresponds to a temperature of 40 million degrees. But since tritium does not exist on Earth, it would have to be created. Neutrons bombarding an isotope of lithium, Li6, would transmute some of that light metal to tritium, much as neutrons made plutonium from U-235. But the only obvious source of such necessarily copious quantities of neutrons was Fermi's unproven pile. The luminaries did, however, consider the possibility of making tritium with the super itself by packing the bomb with a dry form of lithium, lithium deuteride. But lithium, in its natural form, like uranium in its natural form, contained too little of the desired isotope. To be effective, the Li6 would have to be separated. But lithium, element number 3 on the periodic table, would be much easier to separate than uranium. So the arguments progressed across the pleasant Berkeley summer. "We were forever inventing new tricks," Betha says, "finding ways to calculate and rejecting most of the tricks on the basis of the calculations. Now I could see at first hand the tremendous intellectual power of Oppenheimer, who was the unquestioned leader of our group. The intellectual experience was unforgettable." At the end of the summer, merging the Serber subgroup's work with their own, the luminaries concluded that the development of an atomic bomb would require a major scientific and technical effort. Glenn Seaborg heard Oppenheimer's deduction from that outcome at a meeting of the MetLab Technical Council in Chicago on September 29th. "Fast neutron work has no home," Seaborg paraphrases the Berkeley theoretician, "and may need one." "Oppenheimer has plans in mind for fast neutron work," Compton told the council. Oppenheimer was scouting a site where the bomb might be designed and assembled. He thought such an operation might find a home in Cincinnati or with the plutonium production piles in Tennessee. James Brian Conant heard the results of the Berkeley summer study at a meeting of the S1 Executive Committee in late August 1942 and jotted down a page of notes under the heading Status of the Bomb. The fission bomb, he wrote, would explode according to the luminaries with 150 times energy of previous calculation, but, bad news, would require a critical mass 6 times the previous estimated size, 30 kilograms U-235. 12 kilograms of U-235 were enough to explode, Conant noted, but inefficiently with only 2% of energy. News of the super then startled the NDRC chairman to a slip of the pencil. "To detonate, 5 to 10 kilograms of heavy hydrogen liquid would require 30 kilograms U-235. If you use 2 or 3 tons of liquid deuterium and 30 kilograms U-235, this would be equivalent to 10 to the 8th tons of TNT. Estimate devastation area of 1,000 square kilometers, or 360 square miles. Radioactivity lethal over same area for a few days. Conant then drew a bold line with a steady hand and initialed the file note JBC. As an afterthought, or at a later time, he added, S1 Executive Committee thinks the above probable. Heavy water is being pushed as hard as it can. First 100 kilograms of D will be available by fall of 1943, before 60 kilograms of U-235 will be ready. A formal status report went off immediately from the Executive Committee to Bush. It predicted enough fissionable material for a test in 18 months, by March 1944. It estimated that a 30-kilogram bomb of U-235 should have a destructive effect equivalent to the explosion of over 100,000 tons of TNT, much more than the mere 2,000 tons estimated earlier. And it dramatically announced the super. If this U-235 unit is used to detonate a surrounding mass of 400 kilograms of liquid deuterium, the destructiveness should be equivalent to that of more than 10 million tons of TNT. This should devastate an area of more than 100 square miles. The committee, Briggs, Compton, Lawrence, Urey, Eager Murphree, and Conant, concluded by judging the bomb project important beyond all previous estimates. We have become convinced that success in this program before the enemy can succeed is necessary for victory. We also believe that success of this program will win the war if it has not previously been terminated. On August 29th, Bush bumped the status report up to the Secretary of War, noting that the physicists of the Executive Committee are unanimous in believing that this large added factor, that is, the super, can be obtained. The ultimate potential possibilities are now considered to be very much greater than at the time of the last report. The hydrogen bomb was thus under development in the United States onward from July 1942. The problem that Leo Szilard would call the trouble at Chicago, the problem of authority and responsibility for pile cooling design and much more, erupted in a brief rebellion at the Met Lab in September. Stone and Webster, the construction engineers the Army had hired, had spent the summer studying plutonium production. Classical engineers, Leona Woods calls them, who knew bridges and structures, canals, highways, and the like, but who had a very weak grasp, or none at all, of what was needed in the new nuclear industry. The firm sent one of its best engineers to brief MetLab leaders on production plans. The scientists sat deadly still, with curled lips. The briefer was ignorant. He enraged and frightened everyone. An exasperated Compton protege, Volney Wilson, an idealistic young physicist responsible for pile instrumentation, called a confrontation meeting soon afterward on a hot autumn evening. As a student, Wilson had analyzed the motions of swimming fish and invented the competition swimming style known as the dolphin. With it, he had won in Olympic tryouts in 1938, but then suffered disqualification because the style was new and thus unauthorized. A purblindness on the part of the Olympics judges which may have conditioned Wilson's attitude toward authority. In his memoirs, Compton mixes up the autumn meeting with the similar disagreement in June. Woods, who worked for Wilson, remembers it better. We, some 60 or 70 scientists, assembled quietly in the Commons Room at Eckert Hall, open windows bringing a hot, humid air in with an infinitesimal breeze. No one spoke. It was a Quaker meeting. Finally, Compton entered carrying a Bible. Compton thought that the issue of Wilson's meeting was whether the plutonium production should be undertaken by large-scale industry or should be carried out by the scientists of the metallurgical project, keeping control in their hands. Instead, it seemed to me that the primary issue was to get rid of Stone and Webster. Compton vouchsafed a parable. Without introduction, he opened his Bible to Judges 7:5-7. and read to Leo Szilard and Enrico Fermi, to Eugene Wigner, to John Wheeler, and 80 serious scientists, the story of how the Lord helped Gideon sort among his people to find a few good men to fight the Midianites when there were too many volunteers at hand, to demonstrate clearly that the victory would be entirely the work of the Lord. When Compton finished reading, Woods remembers, he sat down. Not surprisingly, there was more Quaker meeting silence, or astonishment. Then Volney Wilson stood to direct a well-considered fire and brimstone at the incompetence of Stone and Webster. Many others in the group spoke as well, all opposing the Boston engineers. After a while, silence fell, and finally everyone got up and disbanded. Compton had reduced the discussion to a demand that the Met Lab capitulate to his authority. Fortunately, the assembly of scientists ignored him. The Army would soon move the responsibility for plutonium production into more experienced hands than Stone and Webster's. When the change was proposed, Compton eagerly endorsed it. Szilard responded to the struggles at the Met Lab with anger that by now, after 4 years of frustration, had begun to harden into stoicism. Late in September, he drafted a long memorandum to his colleagues that addressed specific Met Lab problems, but also considered the deeper issue of the responsibility of scientists for their work. In draft, and more moderately in finished form, his examination by turns compliments and savages Compton's leadership. In talking to Compton, I frequently have the feeling that I am overplaying a delicate instrument. Beyond personality, Szilard pointed to a destructive abdication by those whom Compton led. I have often thought that things would have been different if Compton's authority had actually originated with our group, rather than with the OSRD. He elaborates in the finished memorandum. The situation might be different if Compton considered himself as our representative in Washington and asked in our name for whatever was necessary to make our project successful. He could then refuse to make a decision on any of the issues which affect our work until he had an opportunity fully to discuss the matter with us. Viewed in this light, it ought to be clear to us that we, and we alone, are to be blamed for the frustration of our work. An authoritarian organization had moved in, had been allowed to move in, to take over work that had been democratically begun. There is a sprinkling of democratic spots here and there, but they do not form a coherent network which could be functional. Szilard was convinced that authoritarian organization was no way to do science. So were Wigner and the more detached Fermi. If we brought the bomb to them already made on a silver platter, Szilard remembers hearing Fermi say, there would still be a 50-50 chance that they would mess it up. But beyond debating the virtues of contractors and cooling systems, only Szilard continued to rebel. We may take the stand that the responsibility for the success of this work has been delegated by the President to Dr. Bush. It has been delegated by Dr. Bush to Dr. Conant. Dr. Conant delegates this responsibility, accompanied by only part of the necessary authority, to Compton. Compton delegates to each of us some particular task, and we can lead a very pleasant life while we do our duty. We live in a pleasant part of a pleasant city, in the pleasant company of each other, and have in Dr. Compton the most pleasant boss we could wish to have. There is every reason why we should be happy, and since there is a war on, we are even willing to work overtime. Alternatively, we may take the stand that those who have originated the work on this terrible weapon, and those who have materially contributed to its development have, before God and the world, the duty to see to it that it should be ready to be used at the proper time and in the proper way. I believe that each of us has now to decide where he feels that his responsibility lies. The Army had been involved in the bomb project since June, but the Corps of Engineers, Colonel Marshall, had been unable to drive the project ahead of other national military priorities. Divided between the OSRD and the Army, it began to look as if it might lose its way. Bush thought he saw a solution in an authoritative new military policy committee that would retain the project under partly civilian control, but delegate direction to a dynamic army officer and back him up. "From my own point of view," he wrote at the end of August 1942, "faced as I am with unanimous opinion of a group of men that I consider to be among the greatest scientists in the world, joined by highly competent engineers, I am prepared to recommend that nothing should stand in the way of putting this whole affair through to conclusion, even if it does cause moderate interference with other war efforts." Bush had discussed his problems with the general in charge of the Army Services of Supply, Brehon Sommervell. Independently, Sommervell worked out a solution of his own, assigning entire responsibility to the Corps of Engineers, which was under his command. The program would need a stronger leader. He had a man in mind. In mid-September, he sought him out. "On the day I learned that I was to direct the project which ultimately produced the atomic bomb," Albany-born Leslie Richard Groves wrote later, "I was probably the angriest officer in the United States Army." The West Point graduate, 46 years old in 1942, goes on to explain why. "It was on September 17, 1942, at 10:30 a.m. that I got the news. I had agreed by noon that day to telephone my acceptance of a proposed assignment to duty overseas. I was then a colonel in the Army Engineers, with most of the headaches of directing $10 billion worth of military construction in the country behind me. For good, I hoped. I wanted to get out of Washington, and quickly. Brehon B. Sommervell, my top superior, met me in a corridor of the new House of Representatives office building when I had finished testifying about a construction project before the Military Affairs Committee. 'About that duty overseas,' General Sommervell said, 'you can tell them no.' 'Why?' I inquired. 'The Secretary of War has selected you for a very important assignment.' 'Where?' 'Washington.' 'I don't want to stay in Washington.' 'If you do the job right,' General Sommervell said carefully, 'it will win the war.'" Men like to recall in later years what they said at some important or possibly historic moment in their lives. I remember only too well what I said to General Sommervell that day. I said, "Oh." As Deputy Chief of Construction for the entire U.S. Army, Groves knew enough about the bomb project to recognize its dubious claim to decisive effect and be thoroughly disappointed. He had just finished building the Pentagon, the most visible work of his career. He had seen the S-1 budget. It amounted in total to less than he had been spending in a week. He wanted assignment commanding troops, but he was career Army and understood he hardly had a choice. He crossed the Potomac to the Pentagon office of Sommervell's chief of staff, Brigadier General Wilhelm D. Steyer, for a briefing. Steyer implied the job was well along and ought to be easy. The two officers worked up an order for Sommervell to sign, authorizing Groves to take complete charge of the entire project. Groves discovered he would be promoted to brigadier, for authority and, in compensation, in a matter of days. He proposed to delay official appointment until the promotion came through. "I thought that there might be some problems in dealing with the many academic scientists involved in the project," he remembers of his initial innocence, "and I felt that my position would be stronger if they thought of me from the first as a general instead of a promoted colonel." Steyer agreed. Groves was 1 inch short of 6 feet tall, jowly, with curly chestnut hair, blue eyes, a sparse mustache, and sufficient girth to balloon over his webbing belt above and below its brass military buckle. Leona Woods thought he might weigh as much as 300 pounds. He was probably nearer 250 then, though he continued to expand. He had graduated from the University of Washington in 1914, studied engineering intensely for 2 years at MIT, and gone on to West Point, where he graduated fourth in his class in 1918. Years at the Army Engineer School, the Command and General Staff College, and the Army War College in the 1920s and 30s completed his extensive education. He had seen duty in Hawaii, Europe, and Central America. His father was a lawyer who left the law for the ministry and served in a country parish and an urban working-class church before Grover Cleveland's Secretary of War convinced him to enlist as an army chaplain on the western frontier. Entering West Point fulfilled my greatest ambition, Groves testifies. I had been brought up in the army, and in the main had lived on army posts all my life. I was deeply impressed with the character and outstanding devotion to duty of the officers I knew. The dynamic engineer was married with a 13-year-old daughter and a plebe son at West Point. A tremendous lone wolf, one of his subordinates describes Groves. Another, whose immediate superior Groves was about to become, distills their years together into grudgingly admiring vitriol. Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth D. Nichols, balding, bespectacled 34 in 1942, West Point Ph.D. in hydraulic engineering at Iowa State, remembers Groves as "the biggest son of a bitch I've ever met in my life, but also one of the most capable individuals. He had an ego second to none. He had tireless energy. He was a big man, a heavy man, but he never seemed to tire. He had absolute confidence in his decisions, and he was absolutely ruthless in how he approached a problem to get it done. But that was the beauty of working for him, that you never had to worry about the decisions being made or what it meant. In fact, I've often thought that if I were to have to do my part all over again, I would select Groves as boss. I hated his guts, and so did everybody else. But we had our form of understanding." Nichols' previous boss, Colonel Marshall, had worked out of an office in Manhattan, where in August he had disguised the project to build an atomic bomb behind the name Manhattan Engineer District. But decisions of priority and supply were made in wartime in hurly-burly Washington offices, not in Manhattan. And to fight those battles, the colonel had chosen the capable Nichols. Groves therefore sought out Nichols next after Steyer, and found the project in even worse condition than he had feared. "I was not happy with the information I received. In fact, I was horrified." He took Nichols with him to the Carnegie Institution on P Street to confront Vannevar Bush. Somerville had overlooked clearing Groves' appointment with Bush, and the OSRD director was infuriated. He evaded Groves' questions brusquely, which puzzled Groves. Controlling his anger until Groves and Nichols left, Bush then paid Steyer a visit, which he describes in a contemporary memorandum. "I told him, one, that I still felt, as I had told him and General Somerville previously, that the best move was to get the military commission first, and then the man to carry out their policies second. Two, that having seen General Groves briefly, I doubted whether he had sufficient tact for such a job. Steyer disagreed on one, and I simply said I wanted to be sure he understood my recommendation. On two, he agreed the man is blunt, etc., but thought his other qualities would overbalance. I fear we are in the soup." Bush changed his mind within days. Groves immediately tackled his worst problems and solved them. One of the first issues the heavyweight colonel had raised with Nichols was ore supply. Was there sufficient uranium on hand? Nichols told him about a recent and fortuitous discovery, some 1,250 tons of extraordinarily rich pitch blend, it was 65% uranium oxide, that the Union Minière had shipped to the United States in 1940 from its Shinkolobwe mine in the Belgian Congo to remove it beyond German reach. Frédéric Joliot and Henry Tizard had independently warned the Belgians of the German danger in 1939. The ore was stored in the open in 2,000 steel drums at Port Richmond on Staten Island. The Belgians had been trying for 6 months to alert the U.S. government to its presence. On Friday, September 18th, Groves sent Nichols to New York to buy it. On Saturday, Groves drafted a letter in the name of Donald Nelson, the civilian head of the War Production Board, assigning a first priority AAA rating to the Manhattan Engineered District. Groves personally carried the letter to Nelson. His reaction was completely negative. However, he quickly reversed himself when I said that I would have to recommend to the president that the project should be abandoned because the War Production Board was unwilling to cooperate with his wishes. Groves was bluffing, but it was not the bluster that swayed Nelson. He had probably heard by then from Bush and Henry Stimson. He signed the letter. "We had no major priority difficulties," notes Groves, "for nearly a year." The same day, Groves approved a directive that had been languishing on his predecessor's desk throughout the summer for the acquisition of 52,000 acres of land along the Clinch River in eastern Tennessee. Site X, the Met Lab called it. District Engineer Marshall had thought to wait to buy the land at least until the chain reaction was proved. On September 23rd, the following Wednesday, Grove's promotion to brigadier came through. He hardly had time to pin on his stars before attending a command performance in the office of the Secretary of War called to assemble Bush's outmaneuvered military policy committee with Stimson, Army Chief of Staff George Marshall, Bush, Conant, Somerville, Steyer, and an admiral on hand. Groves described how he intended to operate. Stimson proposed a 9-man committee to supervise. Groves held out for a more workable 3 and won his point. Discussion continued. Abruptly, Groves asked to be excused. He needed to catch a train to Tennessee, he explained, to inspect Site X. The startled Secretary of War agreed, and Leslie Richard Groves, the new broom that would sweep the Manhattan Engineer District clean, departed for Union Station. "You made me look like $1 million," Somerville praised Groves when he got back to Washington. "I'd told them that if you were put in charge, things would really start moving." They did. Enrico Fermi began planning a full-scale chain-reacting pile in May 1942, when one of the exponential piles his team built in the west stands of Stagg Field indicated its K at infinity would muster 0.995. The Met Lab was searching out higher-quality graphite and sponsoring production of pure uranium metal, denser than oxide. Those and other improvements should push K above 1.0. "I remember I talked about the experiment on the Indiana Dunes," Fermi told his wife after the war, "and it was the first time I saw the dunes. I liked the dunes. It was a clear day, with no fog to dim colors. We came out of the water, and we walked along the beach." As they began preparations that summer, Leona Woods remembers swimming in frigid Lake Michigan every afternoon at 5 o'clock. Off the huge breakwater rocks at the 55th Street Promontory. She, Herbert Anderson, Fermi. She was still a graduate student, 22 and shy. One evening, Enrico gave a party, inviting Edward and Michi Teller, Helen and Robert Mulliken, my research professor, and Herb Anderson, John Marshall, and me. They played Murder, the parlor game then in fashion. The second the lights went out on this particular evening, I shrank into a corner and listened with astonishment to these brilliant, accomplished, famous, sophisticated people shrieking and poking and kissing each other in the dark like little kids. "All nice people are shy," Fermi consoled her when he knew her better. He had always been dominated by shyness. She records his sly self-mockery. As he frequently said, he was amazed when he thought how modest he was. Woods was finishing her thesis work during the summer, but sometimes helped Anderson scour Chicago for lumber. CP1, Chicago Pile Number 1. Fermi planned to build in the form of a sphere, the most efficient shape to maximize K. Since the pile's layers of graphite bricks would enlarge concentrically up to its equator, they would need external support, and wood framing was light and easy to shape and assemble. "I was a buyer for a lot of lumber," Anderson says. "I remember the Sterling Lumber Company, how amazed they were by the orders I gave them, all with double X priority. But they delivered the lumber with no questions asked. There was almost no constraint on money and priority to get what we wanted." Horseback riding one Saturday afternoon in the Cook County 4